This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 164. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
And you can call us on
0208 816 7691.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway. So it's a two-man show this week, Garraz. We're a man down. Berners is away this week. So it's just you and me to keep each other company for the next half an hour or so.
Crikey, mate. I hope the listeners will be fine with that. We've just got to put a few more overs in than we normally would do.
Exactly, yeah. Some hard yakka, as Simon Jones once said.
Simon Jones or Hughes?
Simon Hughes, yes. Even better. He's probably said it as well.
I'm sure he has over the years, mate. I'm sure he has.
Yeah, yeah. So we've had a conclusion to the IPL.
Yeah.
And it was KKR who came out on top.
Yeah. Good to see somebody different as well, which is great, because obviously Chennai have been very strong in it the last few years, and good to see KKR come to the party and do well. And it actually were one of a couple of us got together, myself and a guy called Sean Morris, who's been very strongly involved in the IPL. We came together in October and identified KKR as being a rising star and just about ready to do something. And to us, it was between three at the start of the competition, and two of those three reached the final, and obviously KKR came out on top, which is good.
And they got there pretty comprehensively as well. They won their qualifying match and then straight through to the final.
Yeah, and I think it's important to peak, isn't it? I remember back to when Somerset won the 2020 and 2005, and we definitely progressed as we went through the tournament in terms of our own performances. So it meant that probably at the beginning, if we'd have played the likes of Lancashire and Leicestershire, who have obviously proven to be very good over the years in 2020 cricket, if we'd have played them at the front end of a competition, possibly they'd have beaten us. But as we progressed through, we got better and better, more confident, more competent our skills, and that's pretty much what KKR have done in this instance as well. They've got stronger as the competition's gone on.
Yeah, not many sides, when you're talking about a long tournament like the IPL or anything like that, not many sides can maintain a dominance right from the start to the end, can they? I mean, the only example I can think of recently, I suppose, is the Australians in the 2007 World Cup, who just seemed to brush everybody aside right from the first game.
Yeah, it is unusual. It is unusual. And you see back to, I think it was 1999 when the World Cup was in England, and Australia actually lost a couple of games during the competition, but then came good and were playing their best cricket. Semi-final, that magnificent semi-final against South Africa, and then the final where they dominated the game against Pakistan. We think back to 1992 in the World Cup when Pakistan were as good as out of the competition, and if it hadn't rained against England, when England were chasing a relatively modest total, then they'd have been knocked out in the group stages, if I remember rightly, and then ended up beating England in that final. And the same with Australia in 1996 when Alan Border's team beat England in that final as well. They were pretty dodgy and not particularly rated in the subcontinent conditions, and then went on to win it and peaking at exactly the right time. So yeah, there's a definite art to it. Sometimes it happens through planning, and sometimes it happens just because cricket's a wonderful game and things come together.
Yeah, exactly. So how did you, in your view, from your sort of view from afar, if you like, I know you've been involved in the IPL, but you haven't been directly involved in it this time. What was it that KKR did tactically that worked so well for them?
I don't know about tactically so much. I think that develops over the tournament. They're again very interested in the analysis side of things, and we've had conversations with them along those lines. They were very, very forward thinking in the way that they were looking to analyse a game, which they all are out there now, because you can't afford with that money around not to be. But I think in their player recruitment in the winter, and I think in their balance in the side as well, and good leadership. You look back on the winners of the IPL so far, and there's been a significant link between leadership and winning, and that's one of the reasons why CSK have been so successful with Mahendra Singh Dhoni at the helm. And KKR have got that bit right, you know, and I wasn't surprised to see them win.
Now, the other thing that has caught my attention this week is I was listening to a little bit of the England West Indies Test match, and they were talking about swing bowling, the mysterious art of swing bowling, and it was the usual sort of talk that you get when the ball doesn't swing. You know, why does it swing sometimes? Why doesn't it swing sometimes? Because Trent Bridge, of course, is a ground where it's traditionally swung more, and it wasn't swinging as much during this Test match. So there's a lot of sort of hearsay, and you know, you've got to have a smaller ball, which is a darker shade of red, and you know, you've got to have the right weather conditions, and but sometimes it doesn't swing when it's overcast, sometimes it does swing when there's a lot of mystery around it, and I was wondering if there is any science around it, you know, any kind of reliable way that you can look at swing bowling, or will it always remain a bit of a mystery because there's so many factors?
Well, I think there are a lot of factors. I mean, yes, there is science behind it, and there's quite extensive science behind it. And I know that Troy Cooley and Kevin Shine at ECB did a lot of research and worked with a guy called Ravi Mehta from NASA, of all places, about how the ball swings, and put lots of balls in wind turbines, and did a heck of a lot of research on what needs to happen for the ball to swing. And there's some great science behind that. And I'll give you one example of that, because I've just pulled up an article about conventional swing, so you know, the normal type of swing type that you see Jimmy Anderson displaying at the start of games. And the wind tunnel test on cricket balls showed that the maximum side force is generated about 70 mile an hour. So when you look at your club cricketers, and a lot of bowlers bowl around 70 mile an hour in club cricket and swing a ball prodigiously, that's because that's the optimum pace to swing the ball maximally, with the seam degrees at 20 degrees towards slip for an away swinger, or towards sort of leg slip for an in swinger to a right hander. And also, the other thing that came out of it was the people that swing the ball the most actually put a little bit of backspin on the ball, which holds the seam on its same path. Whereas if backspin isn't applied onto the ball, the seam tends to wobble a little bit. And that was where you get maximum swing. So the other interesting point is that they worked out that 80 miles an hour gives you the least chance of the ball actually deviating, even if you get the backspin and the seam angle absolutely right, which is quite interesting when you actually look back on that last Test match and have a look at, because it was a hard Test match to bowl in, you know, flat wicket, having to bowl for long periods of time. A lot of the paces were dropping down towards that 80 miles an hour, which may slightly explain why the ball didn't swing from a scientific perspective. There are, as you say, there are other factors involved, and we've just experienced it here at Millfield, actually, in that you get certain batches of balls and certain years, particularly in the Duke's ball that England use in Test matches in England. Some years swing more than others, and you'll hear about that a lot in county cricket, about certain years swinging more than others. And I know back in 2005-06, we found a year, because each ball is stamped at the top level with the year that it's produced on, and we basically got hold as many of the balls as we possibly could from Duke's for that year, and used them for as long, you know, in 2007-08-09, all the way as long as we could, until that batch would actually run out, because we knew that we'd get those balls to swing. We had a batch here at Millfield, and our bowlers have been swinging it around corners with this batch. We ran out of that batch and used exactly the same grade of ball, which looked completely different in terms of its dynamics, and didn't offer any swing movement whatsoever. So there's the factor which comes in, and that's going to happen, isn't it? Because you know, these balls are handmade and aren't going to be absolutely exactly the same every single time that they're made. So there's one of the factors that that comes into play. Other factors may be things like, you know, the moisture in the ground and all of that sort of stuff. But to be brutally honest with you, as a cricket coach, as opposed to a groundsman, that's not something that I can speak with any confidence on. But the science is there. And I think that the pace that people were ended up bowling, which was, you know, largely between sort of 79 and 83 miles an hour, when you look back on that test match, with the odd ball being bowled significantly quicker than that as a variation ball, meant that the ball was unlikely to swing, because that's the pace where the ball is least likely to be able to deviate sideways through the air.
That thing about batches of balls is one thing that it's always made sense to me, but also it's one of those things where I always have in the back of my mind, is that true, or is a bowler somewhere going, oh, it must be a bad batch of balls? Do you know what I mean? A bad workman blaming his tools. I mean, I don't know. I don't bowl, so I don't know. But
that's where county cricket is a great barometer, David, because the same batches of balls get used over a season. And that's where the stats then come into play. And obviously you get the anecdotal views of people that have bowled in it. But there's some quite significant statistical evidence which demonstrates that different batches of balls get different results over a county season. And, you know, people can say, oh, it was a bit wet at the beginning, or it was a bit dry in the middle, or whatever the case may be. But over the course of a county season, largely you get, you know, all types of weather conditions, and it balances itself out. But there's definitely that element to it, and we made sure within the England setup that we had specific year batches, because we had more confidence in those being able to swing for us.
It's time now for the interview section on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, and I'm joined on the line by a friend of the show, Lawrence Houghton from the University of Western Australia, but he's in the UK at the moment, so you're back on British shores, Lawrence, at the moment.
It's been good to get back to the motherland, and I've done my bit. I've stuck through the 4 weeks of coldness and proper. Well, it seems like a winter, but now I've suddenly had a week of nice sunshine and feel like playing cricket again. But,
yeah, it's almost like it's almost autumn-like weather for what you're used to now, isn't it?
It is. But I tell you what, because I've had those 4 weeks of
college
weather, it makes me appreciate it. I've done my time. So.
And one of the reasons you're over here is for the World Congress of Performance Analysis of Sport, which is happening in Worcester. And you're presenting there. So performance analysis is an area that we're very interested in Pitch Vision Academy. So what type of things are going to be going on in that World Congress?
Yeah, well, over the years, sports science has kind of, as we all know, taken more of a forefront in lots of sports, or perhaps not forefront, but certainly a more integral part. Within sports science discipline itself, there's various sub-disciplines, and one of those is performance analysis. And it's essentially saying, well, we can collect data from a match. We can look at, you know, these days as well with GPS units. We can easily, you know, in even cricket games now, we've got plenty of data on how far you run, your movement patterns. If you're playing football, you know, passes you make, or all sorts of. We can get so much data with the technology we've got now. So it's looking at, I guess the conference, that's the heart of the conference, various different sports, you know, basketball, football, gymnastics, athletics even, and saying, here's this data we're collecting, how can we then use it as best to serve the coaches and players, rather than just, you know, being a kind of stats collector and number collector. It's actually collecting it for a reason. So that's kind of what the conference is getting towards, yeah.
That's what a lot of coaches and players who listen to this might say, is that you know, it's all very well being able to gather that information, but it's how does that help me when I'm out in the middle? So what how do you see that connection between the coach and the player, and the academic side of gathering that data?
I guess looking at my PhD, I mean, it was part of it is that, yeah, there's lots of data in cricket now, GPS stuff. How do we actually use it to improve our training? And so that's what I'm going to be talking about at the conference. I'll be saying how we've got this data, and we've actually created this batting simulation called BatX, which I won't go into too much detail now, but obviously because the details are on the Pitchvision website. But essentially, how can we use that data to actually say, actually, now we've got this data, now we can actually create a simulation that's definitely reflective of a match situation. The other side as well, things is potential for future research is collecting that GPS data, but using it as a measure of workload. So obviously these days, everyone's very careful at monitoring how much work a bowler has done. And so there's that other aspect as well. So how do you help out the coach? As much as anything, there is that kind of in cricket as well, because it's not like a football game where things change. You know, your workload in one match can be completely different to another, and it is actually probably quite helpful for a coach to see how much your players worked. I mean, in cricket, in some ways, you can just say, oh, he's bowled this many balls, you've got this many runs. But also presenting that GPS data just gives a real appreciation. I mean, some of the data, you know, shows if you bowled in a day as a bowler, you can sometimes cover, you know, for 20 k's in a day, which is, when you think about it, is a heck of a lot. Okay, you're not running the whole time, but there's two, yeah, those sides of things is that, yeah, you're actually providing that information on that first level and just giving guys an appreciation of what they're doing, and how much they actually do run in a game. So it's not just sitting around on the side of the pitch. It is actually a physically demanding game.
Going back to what you're presenting at the Congress, you're talking about your batting exercise simulator, BatX,
which we do have a
version of it on the Pitch Vision Academy website for coaches and players to use, rather than people who are getting into the research side of things. So
yeah.
What are you going to be talking about at the Congress specifically when it comes to BatX?
Yeah, so it's going to be an overview of the production of BatX. So yeah, looking at the GPS data, producing this simulated batting innings isn't just, you know, made up. It's actually, you know, out of thin air, if you like. It's actually rationalised, and the workloads that you're seeing that you actually run in that BatX simulation, again, that you can get on the website, exactly the same one that we're using in the research. It's designed to reflect the high demands of a 1-800, so it's been matched up with GPS data to show that is the case. So that's the first part of it. But since we've used it, we've used it over the past, I don't know, three-ish years in the academy at UWA and various other players as part of my research. So we've built up quite a bit of data. So I'll be presenting running between the wicket performance data as well. So although if you have available time and gates, you can integrate them into BatX, and you can actually get, you know, the guys, you're running between the wicket speeds, your turn times, your times to complete a single, you know, your sprint times. So we've now got a database where we can actually, guys, especially, you know, the academy, the Ace Cricket Academy, which is part of UWA there, we can run guys through BatX, and we can now kind of grade them, if you like, where they stand. So it's a really batting-specific fitness drill. So presenting some of that data, some of the physiological demands as well, so sweat rate, body temperature, blood lactate, and jump heights. So these things in and of themselves to coaches and players might not be that helpful, but to a strength and conditioning coach, they're quite good in terms of using BatX and using the separate stages as well of BatX, because it can be split up and used for training, like 20-minute blocks. You're saying, okay, this is the physical demand of this block. How does it match into our objectives for training this week? So there's that side of things. So, you know, your heart rates and recovery rate ratios as well. The final point I'll be talking about is actually assessing batting skill. So kind of moving away a bit from the pure physical side of things is, how do we actually assess batting skill during the simulation. And we just use a simple method. It was developed by another researcher called Sean Muller. It's simply classifying your bat contacts as good, bad, no contact, or left. And we've used that, and again, as you can imagine, the guys who are better batsmen have a higher percentage of good bat ball contacts. Obvious stat, which, you know, if you often hear in research, an obvious stat, anything, oh, what's the point in researching that? But still quite encouraging to show that that, you know, Bratix actually does discriminate between player ability, and we can now go on and use it to answer and ask other questions.
And that's very interesting from a research point of view, and yeah. I'm sure that's going to go down very well at the Congress. And also for just the average coach and the average player who wants to use exactly the same system, they can use Batex. They can go to pitchvision.com and they can use Batex, and they can see without having access to time gates or being able to check blood lactate levels or do detailed analysis of ball contact, things like that. They can still use the Batex anyway. So it's the Batex system anyway. So it's definitely a fascinating area and one that we're big fans of here at Pitch Vision Academy. So thank you very much for your time, Lawrence, and good luck when you head over to Worcester in July.
Yep, thanks very much, David. All the best.
Okay, so we're going to head into the mailbag now, and of course every week we have a couple of questions to read out, and we attempt to answer those questions as best we can, and the best question wins a prize, which is an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So with boners away, I'll be in charge of reading out the questions, and Gareth, you can be in charge of answering them, and I'll see if I can chip in as we
sounds good.
Go along. So the first question is from the mysteriously named AK. Hi, I'm a leg spinner and I can bowl accurately at a target, but when there isn't a target, I can't bowl consistently. What's going wrong?
Crikey, where do we start with that one? it does happen, doesn't it? And we see it a lot because over the years we've probably become more obsessed with target bowling. Mm. But the challenge of target bowling, this is where you need to get the balance right, I think, between different practice types, is that we can become very good at bowling at a target, which is low pressure. Which is, often self-reliant practice where we put down a cone or we put down a marker or whatever the case may be. But actually, you know, the skill is to be able to perform consistently under the pressure of match play. And that's where he's probably spending too much time bowling at targets, and simply by bowling more in nets at players, but still assessing your lengths whilst you're mm-hmm. bowling at players would be a good idea. And really getting a balance between your self-reliant practice, your net practice, and your match practice will help to make that consistency go across all three different practice types. The other thing is, so that's from a purely a practice perspective. The other thing is more of a kinesthetic thing. And if you build up your kinesthetics, and particularly in wrist spinners, this is massive because obviously you've got a wrist rotation and the ball coming out of your fingers as well. So you've got to control quite a lot of the things. If you can get a real control of those in your practice, then you're going to be able to take those into the match because the body does remember, as we know, through our ability to teach skill and learn skill to ourselves. So I would say that a great drill for this particular bowler is to get somebody to put markers down where you bowl, but you stand in the crease or you run up and bowl with your eyes closed off a couple of paces, so you're not going to go careering into the stumps, and basically flick the ball out as you would do in the match with your eyes closed, but get somebody to put a marker down wherever that ball pitches. And what happens over time is you get a feedback from where those markers are landing on how that feel, because that's all that length is a matter of feel. It's not a matter of sight, of looking at a target in terms of length and bowling at it. Sight is all about line, so you can pick up line through sight, but your length comes from your kinesthetics of the ball coming out of the hand. So the more that you can do standing with your eyes closed closes down all of your other senses and puts all of the sense into your kinesthesia. And you'll find over time, with the guy at the other end putting down those markers, that marker will become very consistent and the bounces will become very consistent. And you can take your kinesthetics then everywhere. So build up your trust in your kinesthetics by doing that. And then you can take the practice into open eye practice, obviously, and you'll start to build up more consistency over all of your practice against batters in nets and also against batters in matches.
How much would you... look at a bowler's mental processes when you're going through target practice? Do you keep, when you're doing it, do you keep it simple and keep it to sort of the technical, tactical side of it? Or do you go through a bowler's mental process to find out what he's doing even when he's not bowling under pressure?
Yeah, absolutely. And you need to keep throwing in those stimuli, and the situations, and you need to be breaking up the routine, because bowlers in their own self-reliant practice bowling at a target will have a very consistent routine that they do, which means that routine will help define some success when they're bowling at a target. But a game of cricket isn't like that, is it? All right, so a game of cricket, you might get smacked out the ground, and it takes, 5 minutes to get the ball back, or rather than you going through your 25-second routine bowl, 25-second routine bowl. So it's important to break that up. Now, that breaking up can happen in a conversation where you have a conversation for 2 minutes and then see if that person can then get back straight back into their routine and deliver it. It might be that you ask somebody to you might hit a couple of high catches in between each ball, or every now and again in between deliveries to break up that timing sequence. You might then just say, okay, the umpire says you're behind time and there's a 5-run penalty unless you bowl this over within 45 seconds. So then you get them to rush and see if they can actually hold their routine together and hold their accuracy together. So there's lots of ways of artificially breaking up a session, which, although maybe a little bit annoying to the player that's wanting to concentrate on their target, is actually building up the mental toughness and the robustness that if they can keep delivering their skill with this breakdown in their timing routine, then they're going to make themselves more robust when it comes to the variables that come with match play, you know.
The next question is from Ben, and it's another spin question. He's a left-arm orthodox spinner, and what he finds is that he has a problem bowling to left-handers. He's tried over the wicket, round the wicket, flighting it, darting it in, but he just can't do it. He's never been a massive spinner of the ball, but he can get it to do enough. He says he can turn it a foot, which seems like quite a lot to me.
Yeah, right.
but
If he's got a mate in his team that's spinning it more than a foot,
yeah,
then good on him.
maybe he's overestimating that. And he says he varies his pace well, but he can't figure out how to bowl to left-handers. Can you help?
Yes, alignment. That's all it is. And even without seeing the guy bowl, alignment is the crucial thing here. Your bowling action's your bowling action, and if you're used to bowling well to right-handers over the wicket, have a look at where you start from, have a look at where your feet land, and you're being successful because you're being consistent at delivering that angle. Then you need to replicate that angle into bowling at lefty. So start your run up. If you're going to bowl over the wicket, start your run up bowling slightly wider, so everything is aligned in exactly the same way as it would be to a right-hander, yet it's being pointed to the area that you want to land the ball into. And it's as simple as that. It's one of the things that people don't do very often. So they often start from the same point of their run-up for a right-hander as they do to a left. And obviously, you're trying to land the ball in a completely different place. So if you trained your action for years and years and years, then all you need to do is realign it, keep trusting your action, and the ball will go in the right places, and you'll start putting the left-handers under pressure.
Yeah, it's an interesting one that he's tried lots of different ways of doing it. What would be your kind? I mean, obviously, it depends on the particular bowler, but what would be your basic setup for that? Would you keep left arm over bowling as if it was, the same, the mirror of an off spinner to a right hander?
Yeah, you could do. I mean, you can go either way, but what you've got to make sure. So if I'm coming around the wicket, if it's spinning big, right? I mean, he's spinning it a foot here, he's telling me, isn't he? So if he's spinning it a foot, then there's great potential for you to actually bowl around the wicket, pitch the ball in line with the stumps, and then get him out LBW. But you need to make sure that your normal running alignment and your normal bowling alignment is aligned towards pitching the ball onto the skyline. If you can pitch the skyline, going between the stumps at one end and stumps at the other. So that's what you're aligning against. If you're bowling over the wicket, you want to pitch the ball outside off stump. There's often rough outside off stump for a left-hander. But you want to make sure that your alignment is starting and targeting towards where you're looking to pitch the ball. And that often doesn't happen. You often see that people will just put their marker down in exactly the same place for a right-hander and a left-hander, yet you're trying to vary your line by a foot, sometimes even more. And it's all about aligning yourself with the target area being where you're looking to pitch that ball.
Now, the other thing that that springs to mind for me is how much do you practice against bowling to left-handers? Because I know in club practice you don't see that many left-handers. I mean, I know
Correct.
From keeping point of view, whenever a left-hander comes in, I have a little groan to myself because it just feels weird.
Well, there is, and we struggle with that. We haven't got one left-hander in the first team squad.
Really?
So we've had to do a heck of a lot, going back to the previous question of target bowling. We've had to do a heck of a lot of target bowling and simulation. And again, it comes down to that alignment thing. So we've made a real big emphasis on putting cones down, setting pitch vision up so they bowl at left-handed batters on pitch vision, so we know where their lines are going. And we're trying to get as many balls aimed into the top of that off stump for a left-hander by putting that run-up angle slightly out. I know we're talking about seamers a lot here, but getting the run-up angle one step over to the left if they're bowling over the wicket, so everything is being targeted towards that off stump of a left-hander, rather than expecting somebody to make an adjustment at the crease by starting in their same run-up position, which is what you see a lot of young bowlers doing. They run up exactly as they would for a right-handed batter and end up having to shove the ball as opposed to bowl the ball down a line to get it into the right place for a lefty.
Okay, so we have the soapbox feature this week where one of the team gets their chance to rant for a minute about anything cricket related. So Gareth is climbing onto the box as we speak. Let's see what he's got to say. Gareth, over to you.
Well, this one might not take a minute, but I'm quite passionate about it. It's about fielding practice, really. And how many times do we see people drop a catch, a high catch in fielding practice, and then sulk about it, jog off after the ball very slowly, and then put a really rubbishy throw back into the keeper? And one of the things that Duncan Fletcher was massive on is that it's all right to make a mistake, which is to drop the catch, but don't make a second one straight away by not getting that ball back in. And it was something that worked really, really well for England, because we used to train that way. If somebody dropped the ball, they would have to get the ball straight back in to try and get a run out. And we played against Bangladesh in the World Cup in 2007, and one of their batters got a leading edge to the ball, and it went up in the air, and Michael Vaughan dropped the dolliest of all dolly catches, ran back, picked the ball up, flung it over the top of the stumps and ran the bloke out by four yards. So if you drop a catch in the field, then get the ball back in hard, don't make a second mistake, get it in over the top of the stumps and take pride in your practice.
That's all we've got time for on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show this week. But before we go, we have a couple of things to sort out. One is this week's competition winner, which is a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So two spin bowling related questions this week. Gareth, AK's bowling at a cone and Ben's bowling at a left-hander. So which one did you prefer?
I'm going to go with Ben's one, actually. I think the alignment thing, it happens to a lot of people, you know, when they go from right to left-hander and they forget to change their starting point of their run-up so they can bowl that ball into the target area rather than having to change their action to get the ball into the target area. So this week's winner is Ben.
Congratulations, Ben. A prize will be winging itself to you in the terms of a virtual online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at Pitch Vision. com. Now, if somebody wanted to get in touch with us, Gareth, to send in their own question and have their own chance of winning a prize, how could they do that?
You can send your question in to coach@pitchvision.com, yeah, and or give us a call on 0208 816 7691.
You can, and you can tweet us at PV Cricket Coach. You can get us on Facebook, Pitch Vision Academy. Over there, and you can subscribe to the show in iTunes. If you do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, you'll find us. And if you don't want to do a search for Pitch Vision Academy in iTunes, or you don't want to use iTunes, then head over to pitchvision.com, click on the podcast link, and all the information for how to subscribe in pretty much any way you like is on the page. There's also international numbers, so if you're phoning from outside of the UK, phoning from anywhere in the world, then you can do that using our international numbers. And you can phone our UK number from outside the UK as well. So there's no excuse not to get in touch with us. 500 different ways of getting in touch with us. So as the mower goes past.
Yeah, we've got the mower here, just getting ready for our game this afternoon.
Good luck with your game, Gareth. And until next week, we'll see you next time. Cheers, Gareth.
Cheers. Cheers, mate. Take care. Bye.